Welcome to the Franco Podcast.
Welcome to the 2024 Rendezvous de la Francophonie Podcast. I interviewed 8 bilingual or multilingual people for this year's podcast, including Shelley Robinson. Shelley is the executive director of an Ottawa-based nonprofit and a former executive director of the National Campus Community Radio Association. Here's our conversation. When did you start to learn French and how has your learning progressed?
I started, like a lot of Canadian school kids, in elementary school. And then I stopped in grade 10. I wish that I had continued it. And even as a kid, so there had been a French school that I hadn't known about as a kid, but I found out about later when I went to high school. And so I had always wished that I had been thrown into the French school. And a friend of mine who had been raised Anglo at 5 years old was put into like a completely immersive French school and then got French. And yet I also found it really tough to learn French in the context in which I had it. So, you know, we did the trips and I sort of did what I could. And to be honest, I don't have a lot of formal education past that in French. Again, I've always wanted to, but have always been kind of pretty busy with work and stuff. And so haven't intended to take the classes and haven't yet. Now that I live in Ottawa, there's just a lot more bilingualism around. And so what I've been able to pick up has been here. I will say I have a bias against folks who say that they can get by, because I often feel like that's a huge spectrum. And yes. So I don't actually think in any meaningful sense I could get by with my French.
You can order a coffee, I bet.
Yeah, I could probably order a coffee. But if I was like lost in the woods and needed to describe in any sort of detail to somebody on the phone anything, I would really struggle. It is my hope to get back into it. I don't know if I would do it more formally, but it's certainly on a conversational basis, like take some classes. Yeah.
Well, I've been doing the Duolingo thing, which isn't, you know, it isn't ideal or amazing, but, you know, with a fair bit of work, I can write a decent email now in French.
But oh, that's awesome. I think being able to sort of start by reading and writing texts and emails and that kind of thing really then gives you the confidence to like kind of start speaking it.
Yeah, because you just have to think so fast when you're actually having a conversation. And you also, people tend to, in my experience, most people tend to speak French quite fast, or it seems fast to me.
Oh, yeah. And then there's also slang that you're not aware of that they don't use as much if they're doing it in emails. Yeah.
So you talked a little bit about living in Ottawa. What opportunities do you find in Ottawa to use the French you have?
One of the things that I like to do, both to kind of practice my comprehension of French, but also because it gets really frustrating for folks who are francophone, but bilingual, to have to always speak English in the context of me or somebody else there who doesn't speak French. And so one of the ways that I tried to overcome that, because we were involved, both of us, with kind of national community radio things, then there would be meetings where there would be, you know, a mix of folks. And so sometimes if people really started going into things in French, I tried really hard to just let it go and like to take the notes based on kind of what I could do. And because the woods thing, like the reason I don't think I could do it in the woods is because I kind of, there's no context right around me and it's all just has to come from me. But when I have a context for the conversation and then also other people are talking, then I'm able to sort of pick up like, okay, I know that they're talking about this and we've already talked about this before. And so that helped me practice. And it also for me helps underscore that I think sometimes to support bilingualism is to be okay that you're not going to get 100% of everything. And English speakers are really comfortable when that's true for other people, you know, who are like beginning English speakers, but they're not so good at practicing it themselves with other languages. When we would have meetings at the Community Radio Fund of Canada, there were quite a few Francophones there. And so those are some of those meetings where I would be like, you know, go to town, I'm going to take my notes. And then afterwards, I can kind of check in that I haven't missed anything important.
You spend a little bit of time in Halifax at CKDU. Do you have any recollection about the sort of Acadian side of things?
So we had a French language program, Trois Bocanard, on CKDU.
And it's still on.
Oh, is it? That's awesome.
Amazing, eh?
And one of the coolest things that I did in Nova Scotia in relation to community radio, there is a station in Shettycamp. We organized like a regional conference there. And so Shettycamp is definitely a Francophone part of Nova Scotia. And it's very Acadian in that, like, we went to go see live fiddle music as part of what we were doing. And we worked really hard to make things as bilingual as possible in that context. I also got to participate in New Brunswick in Arctic Canada. So there were some folks there. That was another example where there was so much French going on around me. And I was working with like a Francophone staff member of the NCRA. And so, you know, she was doing a lot of the kind of more intense meeting people and kind of doing that conversation. And I was just kind of trying to follow along. So I didn't really feel like when I was in Halifax, I had that much exposure to, well, I say that. I'm like, you know, there are definitely Acadian organizations that are based in Halifax that I had exposure with. But more it's like, you know, when you go to Clare, they have a community radio station that broadcasts primarily in French. And Shedicamp, like I said, that I really kind of got a fuller taste for it. Yeah.
And you have done quite a bit of traveling and you've worked in various parts of the world. Are there other languages that you may have dipped your toe into?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was in Afghanistan in 2005. And I actually think that I had a better working knowledge at the time of Dari than I did of French. And again, I think it's because of the complete immersion. I had a translator who worked with me, but primarily, like, I would be in meetings and every conversation around me full time, all the time, is in Dari. And then the house staff only speak Dari. And, you know, if I was taking like a taxi or anything like that, it's all in Dari. It's the same when I went to Rwanda with Kinyi Rwanda. So again, you have these kind of compound style houses. So you often have house staff. And then you're taking like moto taxis on motorcycles or whatever. In both places, I got a rudimentary, like, you know, 4-year-old, 5-year-old's level, but like, you know, could communicate like organized elements of a conference in Rwanda on the phone, which is harder, all in Kinyi Rwanda. Now, was I too loud when I was trying to do it? For sure. I have that terrible habit of like being extra loud. And then when I don't understand a language or somebody else doesn't understand English as well. But, you know, I got the basics, like, let's book these rooms and, like, you know, that kind of stuff I could do, which I might be able to do in French. But I think that I would probably, maybe having the fallback here is what, you know, would let me off the hook too much. And then in Afghanistan, for sure, the thing I remember most was being in an extremely tense meeting. So it was on the provincial and parliamentary elections. And there were a bunch of warlords who were seeking political legitimacy by running for election. And then during the count process, things got very heated because people got to see, because it was like a manual count process of physical ballots. And so I'm in this meeting with like the governor, and I was at the time working for the representative of the United Nations and blah, blah. And I probably shouldn't have done this, but I was able to kind of say to somebody like, I don't think I said that's a lie, but I was like, that's not true. In Dari, about a Dari conversation, because I was trying to like jump in and clarify a point. Probably a bit too impulsive, but also, you know, like a familiar enough. Again, I think largely because it was so contextualized, right? Like I knew exactly what we were talking about. I knew the terms of that we were using for like ballots and voting and whatever. Because I do actually want to dive into French, I kind of try and think about how could I replicate that experience as much as possible. Yes, I could maybe go to a part of Quebec where they don't speak as much English, although it's pretty penetrative, you know, like I think a lot of people do. Or I could try and go to a different country or something and just fully try and learn what I could in that context. You know, they have those programs where it's the 6 weeks where you go to like an all French kind of environment. My mom did that when she retired. My mom actually has gotten really into French post her retirement. And so I'm turning 50 next year, but you know, I have a little ways to go. So we'll see if I get into French before then. But it's definitely the kind of thing I can see myself doing more deeply in retirement. Yeah.
You mentioned a few things about community radio. Since this is going to be aired on community radio for the month of the Francophonie, would you mind just quickly outlining your vast community radio experience?
Okay. What I actually like to say about community radio, and the reason that it like completely hit me over the head and changed my life, is I grew up in Milton, Ontario, which is basically broadly GTA. It shouldn't have been this way. So like back in the day, my grandfather had like worked for the newspaper, like whatever, but I just didn't really have a sense of kind of local media, right? So everything I saw was from Toronto. And Toronto even then sort of felt like it kind of took up a nationalized space, if you know what I mean. Like, so yes, I had been to Toronto, but that didn't feel like the Toronto I saw or heard about or whatever. And then obviously I saw a ton of American content. And then I moved to Halifax when I was 16. And a guy in my high school math class was on the radio, like made some reference to being on the radio. And I was like, what? So then I found CKDU and the musical taste. I found a couple shows that just cracked open my musical taste because, again, this is like pre-internet or at least pre sort of my access to the internet. So it was things that I had never heard of that I instantly loved. It was such a diversity of programming, diversity of music, diversity of opinions. I just became like a super fan immediately of CKDU as a listener. Mm-hmm. And so then I got involved a few years later when I went to University of Dalhousie. So you don't have to obviously be a student to get involved. But I think that's what kind of gave me the permission, even though I had known someone in my high school had done it. Then I ended up doing community radio work in Afghanistan. So before I worked for the UN, I worked for an all-women's community radio station in Mazar-e-Sharif, which was phenomenal. So this is like a post-Taliban time, and 86% of people in Afghanistan at the time were sort of functionally illiterate. And so oral communication is such a big, you know, thing. And then, you know, there had been such a receding of so much of, well, women's public being in public spaces, and then also just kind of culture, like you weren't allowed to have music and stuff during the Taliban. And so if I took a taxi or if I walked around the bazaar or whatever, everybody was playing Radio Rabia Balkhi, which for me was a giant difference from the Canadian context, because as much as I love CKDU, community radio in Canada is kind of quite marginal. Sounds bad. I don't actually mean it that way, but like we're so dominated by the CBC, which is great as a public broadcaster, and then commercial radio, which I also have listened to a lot of in my time. And so then community radio fills this really important space, but not as many people know about it or listen to it. And so going to Afghanistan, it was like, boom, like they got, so again, in a place where so many people were illiterate, they were getting hundreds of actual letters a week. Most people couldn't even write, and they were still getting hundreds of letters, and everybody was listening. It was amazing. And then I ended up doing community radio again in Rwanda. So I went for a different project, but if there's community radio around, I'm always going to get involved. And so I was doing this class trip with some students from the National University of Rwanda School of Journalism and Communication. And so one of them, she went by the name Barada. She did this program. It's called, like, the translation was like the Love Hour, and she would play like romantic music and whatever. Kinyarwanda, like local music, but also like pop hits, anything, just a melange of like love-oriented music. And so we were just on this class field trip to do a reporting assignment. And then people, from hearing her voice, just talking to her friends in the context of this field trip, thronged her like she was Michael Jackson, because they were like, it's Barada. Oh my goodness, blah, blah, blah. The show is so, and again, I was just like, it was so heartening to see that people were so such giant fans of community radio, and that they also had then room, because there's like a lot of press freedom challenges there. Mm-hmm. And so they had freedom as a university station to sort of say things that would have been harder in some of the government owned kind of newspapers or the official opposition kind of papers and stuff. So that was awesome. I also worked at the National Campus and Community Radio Association, so the NCRA, obviously, where I was happy to, so one, we got a bilingualism grant to help make the NCRA more bilingual, which meant we recruited some Francophone licensed radio stations, which is really cool. And then we created a bunch more bilingual services. We got some bilingual staff members, a lot of which we were able to sort of entrench for a while, a grant that I've also used in my current job to kind of entrench some more bilingualism. Because mm-hmm. even if I'm not bilingual, I try and make sure that the organizations I work for are as bilingual as possible. I also got to work on the first Rendezvous de la Francophonie project, which was really exciting. And then since I left, I did a show at CHUO here in Ottawa for a while, and I stayed on the board of the Community Radio Fund of Canada for a while, and I was recently on the board of CKCU FM, also here in Ottawa. So right now, I'm currently unaffiliated with community radio, but I can't imagine it's going to stay that way for very long.
That was my conversation with Shelley Robinson, who lives in Ottawa, Ontario. You've been listening to the 2024 Rendezvous de la Francophonie podcast, hosted and produced by Catherine Fisher. The podcast celebrates March, the month of the Francophonie, and it was made possible by the Dialogue Foundation, which has a mission to engage in sustainable dialogue with the Francophonie and with all of Canada's diversity. This year's Rendezvous de la Francophonie partners and funders include the Government of Canada, the Linguistic Portal of Canada, the National Film Board, Air Canada, La Fédération de la Jeunesse Canadienne Française, NAVCAN, and many other groups, including the National Campus and Community Radio Association.